next case on our docket is Sharath Chandra, Administrator, Nevada Real Estate Division Appellant versus Melanie Schulte. The caption includes William R. Schulte, but I think this is principally Melanie's argument on behalf of respondents in case number 75477. Mr. Borla, Ms. Davis, welcome. Ready to go?
Yes, sir.
All right.
May it please the court. Ronald Bordelot, Deputy Attorney General on behalf of the Nevada Real Estate Division. The fund was created to help all of those who hire a real estate...
Could you do something for primarily myself?
Sure.
This case comes to us from a divorce case.
Correct, Your Honor.
Would you clarify for me procedurally, particularly in light of our order entered regarding your client's standing, as to how you ended up in a divorce case and what you're doing here and how you got here, please? I'm not trying to insult you. I'm just asking for clarification procedurally as to what orders, who entered them, and how we got here. I think we understand that, but that's one of the reasons we like clarified at the beginning.
It's a great question, Your Honor, and it's often confused. So what generally happens in these fund cases is someone will file, for example, a cause of action for fraud against a real estate licensee in whatever court has competent jurisdiction, and they'll get a judgment. And then pursuant to our statute, NRS 645, you file a petition for fund recovery in that court in which you got the judgment. And so that's why we're coming from a divorce court. Although it really gets to the heart of the matter that it was a divorce court and not a cause of action for fraud, but I'll explain that as I go along. And that's how we got in here, is because the division doesn't actually become involved until you file that petition in the court you got the judgment. Then they serve the division, and the division is part of the case. So we don't actually get involved until that point in time.
How do you interpret the effect of this court's order, though, which said these orders are appealable, but your client lacks standing?
Correct. This court said, and I'll quote, appellant lacks appeal to appeal from these orders, but it also held that it can't appeal from the fund orders. It specifically said it can't appeal from the amended decree of divorce and the individual judgments against William Schulte. However, as I'm going to go into, the jurisdictional rules still apply. The state is neither appealing those judgments, like attacking the amounts awarded or the findings therein, or attacking those individual judgments and the amended decree, but more importantly, those 21 new individual judgments on jurisdictional grounds. So standing is really irrelevant, because this court holds that standing cannot be waived, it cannot be conferred by the parties, and it can be raised at any time by any party and sua sponte by this court. This court also holds that jurisdictional rules go to the very power of the courts to act, and they must accordingly be clear and absolute, and their efficacy only depends on the court's willingness to enforce them.
Was the jurisdictional question raised with Judge Moss below?
I do not know, Your Honor. I took this case over from a senior deputy DAG that retired.
And what is the jurisdictional defect?
The jurisdictional...
Let's start there with your argument. What's the jurisdictional defect with these orders that Judge Moss entered?
That's exactly where I want to start, and then I'm going to go to the, just to give you a brief layout, I'm going to go into the statutory requirement that the final judgment needs to be in reference to any transaction for which a license is required, then the $25,000 statutory cap, and then the statutory spousal exception. So beginning with that jurisdictional issue, it was the court below didn't have jurisdiction to enter the amended decree of divorce, but again, more importantly, those 21 new individual judgments to new parties due to the span of time and due to the fact that the parties, the respondents' LLCs were not parties or plaintiffs to that original divorce action. And this court's decision in Mizorachi is directly on point. This court has long distinguished between an order construing or clarifying a judgment or decree and one modifying it.
But aren't the orders that were entered to compensate, if you don't mind, Ms. Schulte or Melanie, different than the decree of divorce, original and amended? The orders you're appealing from are the orders that impose judgments against a licensee on which a fund claim is based. What is jurisdictionally defective about those orders? Is there anything in the statute that places a statute of limitations or a date constraint on when someone who gets a judgment in a district court against a licensee can or must tender those judgments to your fund?
Exactly, Your Honor, and it's 1 year within our statute. And thank you for the help, I suppose, because that exactly goes to the heart of the matter, is that this decree of divorce was entered nearly 4 years ago, and Mr. Schulte came back almost 4 years later and submitted 21 new individual judgments to the district court, along with the amended decree, circumventing a host of rules. In fact, in order to obtain fund relief, you need to file a cause of action for fraud, which is based on our statute. And they couldn't have done so at that time. Statute of limitations for fraud only had 3 years. So instead, her attorneys initiated this carefully crafted design to make the petition look viable on the surface, including the charade obtaining these multiple final judgments to evade the statutory cap, as I'll further discuss below. However, these petitions and these individual judgments are really just the tip of the iceberg. And just like an iceberg, there's so much more danger than that superficial surface. And so I implore this court to address the jurisdictional issues. And for some reason you disagree that the state can raise them, which I think is contrary to your precedent, then this court can certainly do it sua sponte. And for the four reasons I mentioned before, it is paramount that you do so. Look past that superficial surface and see what's really going on underneath. And I would like to add, in terms of the jurisdictional issue, that the Mizrachi court explains that a modification alters the party's substantive rights, while clarification involves the district court defining rights that have already been awarded to the parties and leaves their substantive rights unchanged. And so the Mizrachi court is based on statutory rules in terms of reopening the case, and the motion to amend which they brought is procedurally effective. And that standard already been awarded and leaves their substantive rights unchanged is paramount, because there are new judgments awarded to new parties. And on top of that, there was modification of liabilities, there was additional monetary compensation and attorney's fees awards. There were new awards, and thus the parties' substantive rights were changed. Thus we have a modification. And Mizrachi actually reaffirmed the standard yet again, citing into a 2012 bail case, in which Your Honor, Justice Hardesty actually clarified the standard, determining that a modification occurred by simply changing a fixed payment to a variable one.
And Ms. Rachi was a court of appeals case that I was on, which was a simple remand to determine what were Jewish holidays. I mean, it was a simple remand to the family court.
The Ms. Rachi case was a Nevada Supreme Court case.
The Ms. Rachi versus Ms. Rachi?
Correct, Your Honor.
That's Judge
Gibbons. 32 Nevada Advanced Opinion 66. Oh, you're right, Your Honor. It is
I apologize for about a year with Mike Gibbons on that one. So
you're correct.
Just a clarification of what the term Jewish holiday meant.
Exactly, and that's the distinction. That's why the Mizrachi court held that a clarification heard. They already said, well, we're going to give parental rights on a Jewish holiday. But the parties weren't sure what was meant by Jewish holiday, so they came back and said, hey, tell us what a Jewish holiday is. And then you're correct, they remanded it back for additional factual findings.
Mr. Bordov, in the clarification modification issue, can it be a hybrid? And just run with me for a minute. If the court said, hey, William owes Melanie $100,000, no relation.
Sure.
And then they come back and they clarify, well, yeah, she owed me $100,000, Melanie, $100,000, but I want you to give it to my 10 to me, 10 to my LLC, 10 to this LLC, so it's still $100,000. With respect to those orders, is that a clarification or a modification?
I believe that's a modification, and I don't think you can do...
But William's still paying $100,000.
William's still paying $100,000, but they added new parties in addition to making the modification.
All the parties are under her control. Like, it's her, it's like, you know, it's not going to her.
They weren't parties to the original divorce action.
Of course not.
And they couldn't have obtained judgments based on this court's jurisprudence. So those judgments giving new awards to new parties are void because they weren't made parties to the action. And this court holds, Schumetzer, that you can't sort of parse part of the order out and part of the order out like that and kind of make it a hybrid. The decree in all respects, except to child and custody support of minor children, becomes unmodifiable six months after the decree was entered. And so this court has held, and it's based on statutory language, that you can't create this sort of hybrid cases because it essentially gives the family court or the district courts or whatever continuing jurisdiction and basically makes these cases never closed and can reopen at any time.
But 125-150 then will give you 3 years if it's discovery of fraud or other issues, correct? Or if there's a compelling reason?
I believe it's after constituting the facts that constitute the fraud or mistake, correct. But I also note that the motion to amend was made 3 years, 7 months, and 5 days after the original decree of divorce. So, you know, I don't know if the distinction between modification and clarification ultimately really matters here, because either way, the motion to amend was untimely either way. I'd like to next discuss NRS 645.844's requirement that the final judgment be with reference to any transaction for which a license is required. Mrs. Schulte has not contested the uncontested fact that Mr. and Mrs. Schulte own the properties and own these LLCs that are associated with those properties before they were divorced. They were marital and community property. And this is evident from the decree of divorce, and you can see many citations in my reply brief, for example, on pages 23 through 24, and I also went to painstaking efforts to trace each property for you, and this is on footnote 7 on your reply 24 for your reference. The Schultes own these properties. They're marital community property, and the act of collecting rents and security deposits on one's own properties is not activity for which a license is required pursuant to NRS Chapter 645. This is well established. In other words, to award fund recovery to any of these companies is basically using the fund to prop up community property or to ensure satisfaction of divorce award, which is directly contrary to the purposes and policies of the statute. Mrs. Schulte and her answer brief completely ignored the rationale from the California Court of Appeals case, Powers v. Fox. And this California case is significant because our legislature specifically said in the legislature history that we were patterned after California. And according to this court, there's a presumption we apply the same construction as that of the parent state. The justices of the California Court of Appeals astutely analyzed. A transaction is not for one which a license is required, even though one of the co-adventurers happens to hold a broker's license. The theory of the statute is that a citizen has relied on the implied representation inherent in the fact of licensure that the licensee is honest and dependable. Instead, here, where the victim and fraudulent actor are married, the reliance is based on the marital relationship with the trust involved therein and on the license. In other words, just because Mr. Schulte had a broker's license doesn't mean Mr. Schulte is entitled to fund relief. The whole point of the statute is that you hire a real estate license and you licensee and you rely on that trust inherent in the licensure.
But can I ask you just so we're not conflating two things? Spousal exception is one issue. The other is, it was a real estate license required. Were the tasks that were undertaken by him, did they require a real estate license, separate and apart from the spousal exception, which is a different issue?
For the properties that are associated with, for today, no, they did not. He did not. It is uncontested that you do not need a license to manage the couple's community property.
Yes.
And that's for the transaction which is required, which a license required argument, correct.
So if you had a licensee who was not unmarried and this claim came against him and not putting money in the trust account under similar circumstances, that would not be covered by the fund?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
So Mr. Schulte ironically made the argument in her answering brief on behalf of all of those others harmed by Mr. Schulte's conduct, the ones who relied on that trust inherent in the licensor, the one who obtained proper rewards for fraud against him, those who are now actually going to be precluded based on Mrs. Schulte's attempts to gobble up everything the fund has to offer for herself.
Did he do something different for them? You're talking about the other people now who are not going to get to recover. Did he do something that required a license for those people that then would bring it under the umbrella of the fund?
Yes, and as you'll see in the reply brief, I actually cite to a case that is on hold right now in the district court. The district court, Judge Hardy, agreed to stay that case pending the outcome of this one, in which fund was awarded. And those people are going to be deprived of any relief.
But what did he do for them that was different than he was doing for the Schulte properties?
He wasn't doing anything specifically different in terms of he was collecting rents and security deposits. But again, the difference is the community doesn't need a he doesn't need a license.
Those are two different things. You're saying that he's not doing things that would bring him under the real estate licensing.
Correct.
Is the fact that he's married may be a different issue, because that goes why you trusted him to do those things. That's a different issue. These other people you're talking about, he was collecting rents and not put him in the trust.
But those were for properties that weren't his own. And that's the distinction. Since these are his own properties, they weren't awarded to Mrs. Schulte as her sole separate property until after the divorce. And nothing happened after the divorce in this case. There were no transactions occurring. There has to be a transaction for which a license is required. No transactions occurred. And again, the policy and spirit of the law and the legislative history made clear that it's based on the trust inherent in the licensure. And of course, there was no reliance after the divorce because nothing happened after the divorce in this case. Next, I'd like to, unless there's any more remaining questions, I see my time is almost out. I'd like to perhaps save the remainder of time on rebuttal and request potentially another 2 minutes, if possible. Thank you, Your Honor.
We asked you some questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal. You'll have a minute seven. Ms. Davis?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Amberly Davis here on behalf of Ms. Schulte and the nine LLCs. These cases were originally brought separately and distinctly in small claims court. The small claims judge said this, Mr. Schulte showed up and she said, this is too complicated. It needs to go back to the original divorce court because I think that that court has the institutional knowledge and is the correct court. And she dismissed the case. So we went back to, we hired the original divorce attorney, went back into the divorce court. We had evidentiary hearings, and then the orders were entered. When they weren't collectible, then we filed the verified petitions. And when NRED through the department, or you know, the real estate division, showed up, their answer was very sparse. They specifically didn't request an evidentiary hearing. I mean, we'd already had one, but they could have requested, because that's not proof of everything. They get to re-answer and retry it. And their answer was only, she's not the spouse, and...
She is the spouse.
She is the spouse, which we argued she's not the spouse. And one other issue, which I don't have right here. But that was it. And so when specifically asked on the record, do you want an evidentiary hearing, before she made her rulings, Deputy Kaiser said, no, we don't want an evidentiary hearing. So here we are. So there's no evidentiary hearing about when the funds were purloined. Was it, in fact, after, because the court came in and ordered that the Schulte, the ones we're calling the Schulte properties, there was originally 40-something of them. And then there was Sabrico, which was a property management company. These funds were diverted from the Schulte properties, which were part of Melanie's to operate during the divorce. The funds were diverted from those into the Sabrico accounts solely under the control of the broker and permitted property manager. Now, he did that using his brokerage license. He signed all of those as broker of Sabrico. And so that could have all been brought out. We did bring it out initially, but it's not in the findings of fact. And it wasn't requested from NRED that we review it again during an evidentiary hearing. So we don't get to see how he used his license.
So did NRED challenge the jurisdiction below?
No.
As they are here?
No. They did challenge the spouse. And part
they
of
did challenge the what?
The spousal issue.
Oh.
And part of it is that at the time of the marriage, you know, they were married, they got separated and filed for divorce, the assets were divided, and during that time, it's discovered that $2.9 million thereabouts is missing in the Sabrico control. You then have a bookkeeper who's... There's a trial that's going to go on for missing monies. You have the AG's office involved. The bookkeeper dies before trial. All of that happens, too. And it takes a long time for the divorce to happen. So,
but once the divorce happens, what gives the district court, the family court judge, the authority to enter this new order non-proton? Under what rule can the judge do this?
And I'm not a family law attorney, and so I do apologize if I can't cite to the specific statute. What I can say is that Ms. Schulte was having huge problems on the actual, whether you want to call it an amendment or a change. There were things like she was awarded these 32 properties. But because they weren't listed out and the LLCs weren't listed out, she couldn't get information from the banks, and they were returning her payments on those. In fact, she actually had to go into bankruptcy on those properties because of that issue. And so
I appreciate your explanation, but what would we look to in this record to help the court understand whether the amended decree was intended to be a clarification or is a new a modification?
The actual motion and then comparing the two orders.
That's all we've got to work with then.
Well, there are transcripts that could be made available from
them. But they weren't submitted as part of the appendix.
But they weren't submitted.
What do you do with Mr. Portillo's argument, though, that the motion to, whether it's to modify or to clarify, is filed beyond the period of time allowed under Rule 60 and is filed beyond the time, 3-year period, allowed by the divorce statute?
I would say that allowing a third party to come in and mess with the divorce order that was so hard to get clarified so that we could go back to the banks and force them to accept payments would be a gross injustice.
Well, perhaps. I appreciate your point, but Mr. Portillo argues that under this Chapter 645, under which these petitions were presented to the district court, that they were presented more than 1 year allowed by that statute for judgments to be entered against the fund. Is that true?
No. So the judgments...
Walk me through the timing then.
So, and I don't have...
Let's assume for the moment that the court were to agree with you that the 3-year period under the divorce statute or the 6-month period under Rule 60 is not applicable, but that this 1-year period under Chapter 645 might be in play.
Because in April we had a hearing that was
the
original.
You need to give me some years.
April 2017.
Okay.
Then in May of 2017 we have that order. Then we immediately try and serve the writs. And then by November 30th of 2017, we're in court with Mr. Kaiser arguing about the writs. So that has to be less than a year.
In the district court.
In the district court.
Okay.
Before Judge Moss.
All right.
So that's definitely within the year.
And these writs.
Yes.
Were they named the division as
so
defendants?
The original writs would named Mr. Schulte.
Yeah.
Because we sought after Mr. Schulte, and then there's an order. There's a verified petition, then the answer, then there's the order directing payment.
And the order directing payment, that's the first time that the division's name shows up in a pleading?
No, it really shows up in the petition for the petition for the order. And that's okay. When then they show up in the case.
And when were those petitions filed?
Those petitions were filed, I believe, in May.
Of 2017?
Yeah.
Okay. Within the 1-year period?
Within the 1-year period.
I see.
Because we had to argue with the family court. They didn't want to allow NRED to file their answer. And we had to go down and say, no, we just served them. They have to be allowed to answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so Judge Moss's clerk had to call down and say they have to be allowed to answer.
And these petitions were preceded by evidentiary hearings between Melanie Schulte and William Schulte.
Yes.
Litigating what?
Whether or not it was fraud, whether or not the money was taken, whether or not he used his license, whether or not it was Sabrico.
Are there findings with respect to each of those issues by Judge Moss?
There's findings. When we wrote it up, she had us include some findings, but it says that finding that he used Sabrico, There's a finding that the monies were taken and the amount of the monies. She didn't
know. Was there an evidentiary hearing on all of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we were there for half a day.
But you say there are findings. What pleading, what document, what order embodies these findings you're talking about? Is this just on the transcript, or is this set forth in some kind of a judgment?
They're set forth in the May 18th order from the April 3rd hearing, and then they're set forth again in the petitions, the verified petitions, yeah. And then set forth again because we kept writing.
But is the May order the same one that amended the decree? Or is that a separate
order? It's a separate order.
Okay. All right.
And I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just to clarify.
Because she had us do multiple hearings.
I understand. But the decree, you got the decree amended.
Mr. Keller did, yes.
Yes, and that was amended. I'm looking for the amendment.
Is that the May 18th? Or is that before then?
Well, what I'm trying to understand is there a separate order that sets out these findings that are the work product of this evidentiary group of evidentiary hearings?
I believe, Your Honor, in the joint appendix, page 44.
Mm-hmm.
If you'll notice, there's a separate order which has the findings of what the court found in each one, and it lays them out.
And that's separate from the amendment to the decree?
Yes.
Okay, because as I understand, and I may be fouled up here, but as I understand Mr. Bordelov's argument, he is focusing our attention on the date that the amended decree was entered.
Right, and the amendment...
And you're saying that the order that forms the basis for Mr. Schulte's liability for this fraud is set out in the order you just referenced in the joint appendix.
Yes, sir.
And that's the product of a separate petition that your client filed.
Well, that's the product of a series it was a motion and hearings.
Okay. And then once you got the judgment from the district court, where the district court made these findings, you then say, I'm going to go collect from the fund, and you file a petition.
We tried to collect from him first, and then we tried to collect from the fund.
Got it. I appreciate the clarification.
I understand it's confusing, sir.
So that takes us to the merits. What say you about the marital privilege and the cap?
So, as to the cap, these were different LLCs. These weren't the same, unlike other cases where you're looking at a single transaction occurrence or two transactions and occurrences. This was multiple transactions and occurrences that were each unique, and we proved up. And I go to the Buechler case, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing their name. If you look, even though the court said there's not four judgments, they did give them two judgments, against each of the real estate agents, and they said their cause of action was joint, but they gave them two judgments, which was for more than the original cap of the 10,000. Now it's 25,000. So we believe that these are nine separate judgments because these were separate and unique LLCs.
Let me ask you a question. So, Ms. Davis, once the petitions are filed, you file a petition with the court, NRED responds to that petition and really only raises the factual issues, like the merits issues, one being the spousal issue. You told me at that time they were offered an evidentiary hearing.
Yes.
And they declined?
They declined, and it's in the transcript.
And so with respect to the spousal privilege, they declined to explore that in an evidentiary hearing?
Yes.
To determine whether they were separated together, what dates these occurred?
Yes.
Okay.
Would you like the reference to that?
No. Yes, ma'am.
Or
I would.
You'd like it.
You would? Okay. That would be on appendix page, the joint appendix, page 174. And that's line 4. The court, because I haven't heard from the other side if they requested an evidentiary hearing. If you feel he wants it, and Mr. Kaiser, no.
Okay. You have about 45 seconds. I'll add a minute to your time also if you'd like to add anything else or wrap up.
We believe this is not about propping up the marital estate. This was fraud perpetrated by a licensee who NRED didn't police when he was able to submit. He didn't submit reports for years about these tenant deposit funds. It was Ms. Schulte who went and filed the complaint against him. And Ms. Schulte had to pay out, for example, the Arshinskuskis, who sued her personally. And of these 9 judgments, the one that was made out not to the LLC but directly to Ms. Schulte is the one the district's already paid. So we believe that this is an unfair statement to look at and say, well, the spousal exception applies. Oh, well, wait a minute. You know, you've already paid Melanie on the one that was made to Melanie, not to the LLCs. So we feel that that should be taken into effect. And they had their opportunity to explore when these were done. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Any other questions I could answer?
Don't think so.
Beginning with the transcript, I just want to point out that if the court reads the pages before, including on Joint Appendix 172, Mr. Kaiser's N-171 is asking specific questions, and the court says a while ago we took testimony under oath, and it was established, and the orders were signed. And the court basically goes into saying how we've already done all this beforehand, so you don't need an evidentiary hearing. And then if you go to that specific question, which counsel pointed to, she's basically saying, the court saying, have you requested an evidentiary hearing? And he said no. The court didn't say, do you want an evidentiary hearing? And I don't know if that's a distinction without a difference.
Did they ever ask for one?
I don't know, Your Honor. I don't know if they did. Second, in terms of Justice Silver's question, there is no rule, there's no statute that permitted them to amend the decree of divorce and enter those new individual final judgments on behalf of new parties. And going back to Justice Hardesty's questions, they all resulted from the motion to amend. And you can see this from the motion to amend itself, Joint Appendix 286. And then finally, I'll note that the real issue here is that there was no the fund is based on the trust inherent in licensure. And that's not what we have here. Mr. and Mr. Schulte were husband and wife. The trust was based on the marital relationship. They were not real estate licensed and real estate client. And then the court in Buhecker has laid out clear guidelines that you can't create a facade of creating multiple individual final judgments to avoid the statutory cap and deprive all of those others who were harmed, the ones who hired Mr. Schulte, relied on that trust and inherent in licensure, the ones who obtained proper tools for fund, the ones who will now be precluded. And again, I submit the court should address the jurisdictional issue. It's paramount importance in this case.
On that point, I'd like to ask you a hypothetical. Let's assume for the moment that in the original divorce proceeding, the divorce court had been presented with the question of a husband, in this case, who committed fraud and injured the community, and as a consequence concluded that the husband owed the wife a substantial sum of money as a result of that. What precludes a party who secures that judgment, if it's a licensee, from presenting that judgment in the manner in which Ms. Schulte did here on petitions that for which the fund can request evidentiary hearings? Aren't those the orders we should be focused on rather than the divorce decree itself?
If I understand the hypothetical correctly, I think it's still based on the trust inherent in the licensure, so I suppose it would depend on the facts of this case, whether Mr. Schulte actually hired Mr. Schulte, which did not occur in this case, nor did the LLCs hire Mr. Schulte. He was managing those properties for the benefit of the community, and you don't have a license to do that.
The findings in the order entered by Judge Moss in response to the request for these judgments address that question factually?
No, Your Honor. They do not.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Yes, thank you for your excellent arguments and briefs. The court will be in recess for 5 minutes so that other counsel can come forward in the next case. We thank you very much. The case will stand submitted.
Thank you.